You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says we can learn a lot about philosophy and how to use it in our daily lives from the TV sitcom The Good Place. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, checking in with reporters around the state about the stories they're covering. First, the nurses at the UW Hospital and Clinics in Madison have voted in favor of reforming a union. They're pushing hospital administration to recognize it. Chemaine Mills is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Chemaine, thanks for being here.
Hi, Rob.
Well, nurses are trying to revive this union. What happened to the previous union?
Well, they had a union as recently as 5 years ago. But like a lot of other unions in the state, it ended after a law known as Act 10. That law didn't forbid unions, but it made it more difficult for them to exist and maintain members. Moreover, what those members could bargain for was greatly restricted. So it was basically inflationary pay increase and not so much work conditions. It wasn't as all-encompassing as it used to be.
Are there issues UW nurses now are talking about that they say spurred this new effort to get their union recognized?
It's basically working conditions and job stability. For instance, if they go into a disciplinary procedure, they want to have a witness or some intermediary with them, so it's not just the employer and the employee. And working conditions, they say they don't have enough staff oftentimes. Many of them may have to care for as many as 8 patients at a time when 4 is the standard. And there's not always enough beds in the emergency room, so some of the patients end up in the hallway overnight.
Now, nurses are asking hospital administration to recognize their union organizing efforts. Has the administration of UW Hospital and Clinics responded?
Not to that question. They haven't said whether or not they will recognize the union. They have said in the past that Act 10 prevents them from recognizing a union. So what the nurses are asking is, we don't have to do collective bargaining per se. We can do something similar called meet and confer. But the administration has not agreed to that.
So what's the next step you're watching for?
Well, see if the administration will agree to accede to some of the demands of the nurses. Basically, more staff, more stability. One thing they haven't talked about, at least publicly, is pay.
All right. We'll watch for that. Chemaine, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Chemaine Mills is a WPR reporter. She talked with us about nurses at UW Hospital and Clinics in Madison trying to revive some form of the union that was phased out as a result of 2011's Act 10. Now authorities are learning more about an October shooting in Wausau's Pine Grove Cemetery that left one person dead and 2 others wounded. Natalie Brophy is the urgency reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald, covering crime and breaking news. Natalie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Well, Natalie, 64-year-old Henry West charged with this killing and other crimes. What have we found out about his past and what had led him to this shooting in October?
Yeah, well, police, you know, haven't released the specific motive, but court documents show that at the time of the shooting and the fire, he was in the process of being evicted from his apartment building, the apartment building where the fire started. And also one of the managers at the apartment reported to police after the shooting that West had made threatening comments about former coworkers at the cemetery.
And in addition to the shooting, you mentioned a fire at his house. He had rigged his home with explosives. And this is new news, I think. Police dispatch had gotten a phone call from a man they believe may have been him, West, the suspect, on the day of the shooting, warning them about these explosives. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so the call came in to Marathon County 911 in between the time of the shooting and the fire. So the fire happened, was called in first, and then about 15 minutes later, the shooting at the cemetery. So that call was made, you know, in between those two events, and it was a man's voice. He was breathing heavy, and basically he told the dispatcher that to warn the firefighters down at the apartment in Schofield because there were flammable liquids inside the apartment. The dispatcher attempted to get more information from the man, but he had hung up the phone. And in the that recording that the Los Angeles Daily Herald got as part of an open records request, that call specifically was labeled 911 call possible from suspect in shooting, in shooting fire. So, that was that call.
And these explosives happily did not go off in the fire. What have police or others said about what might have happened if they had gone off? What kind of damage could we have seen?
Yeah, police estimated that, had the explosives gone off, hundreds of people could have been injured or killed, including first responders who are at the apartments, putting out the fire, people who lived in the apartment buildings, businesses and homes nearby as well.
And finally, where does the court case against Henry West stand right now?
He has an arraignment scheduled for early February, and that's when he'll put in a plea to all the charges against him.
Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks again.
That's Natalie Brophy, urgency reporter at the Wausau Daily Herald. She gave us an update on the case of a deadly shooting in the city's Pine Grove Cemetery back in October. Now, construction continues on Foxconn's manufacturing plant in Kenosha County. There's new uncertainty about whether the company can find enough workers for its project and if its contract with the state is going to hold up as written. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the State Department of Administration got a letter apparently this week from Foxconn executives about the company's search for workers. What is Foxconn saying?
Well, Foxconn is saying that they have been looking for workers and they just cannot find enough in Wisconsin. They say that they've traveled the country. They went to North Carolina, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky to try to attract talent to Wisconsin, and they've fallen short.
You talked with worker placement firms and lawmakers about what they think might be behind that shortage of workers. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, what I'm hearing is that, the unemployment rate is very low, and that people want to keep their good employees, so they're doing everything that they can to retain workers. And employees just aren't moving like they used to. People used to leave the state to go to other jobs, and people aren't doing that anymore. So Foxconn could very well be having trouble.
We're also finding out about some tension between Governor Evers and Foxconn about the company's contract with the state and whether the plan has changed too much to keep the old deal in place. What's going on there?
Well, Governor Evers said Thursday that he thinks the state and Foxconn will renegotiate the contract because the company is no longer building the project that they promised when they first agreed to the deal. Foxconn also confirmed that they're in talks with the state, although they're not specifying what kind of changes they're discussing.
And what has Foxconn said about how well it's keeping up its end of the bargain?
Foxconn says that they're upset at being asked to make changes. Foxconn says that they're committed to Wisconsin, although in a text message earlier this week with WPR, Alan Young, who is one of the Foxconn executives, said that, with this Generation 10.5 plant that they were going to do originally, that would have employed 3,000 workers. This new Generation 6 plant will employ 1,500 people. So there is some discrepancy in the number of employees.
We'll watch to see how that shakes out. Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Corrine Hess, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She talked with us about where things stand with Foxconn's search for workers and its contract with the state. And that finishes up our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. Coming up, everything is fine. Students are picking up demonstrations of philosophy concepts from a TV sitcom. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, can smarter markets save America's healthcare system and its economy? Our guest has some ideas. First, Kant, Hume, Descartes, Eleanor, Chidi, Michael. What those names all have in common is they're being used to teach a college intro course on philosophy. Robin Zabrowski has built a lesson plan around the NBC sitcom The Good Place, a comedic exploration of the afterlife and morality, helping bridge the gap between long-dead philosophers and modern-day undergrads. Robin is an associate professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. She joins me now in the studio. Robin, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you started watching the show for fun, I understand. What made you think, hey, wait, this is going to be a valuable lesson for my students?
By like the second or third episode, I was teaching Intro to Philosophy at the time, and I found myself going, oh, I wish all of my students had watched last night's episode so that I could talk to them about it. And I discovered that one or two of my students in that class were also watching it, and they would stay after class, and we would get all excited and talk about it. And I said, well, obviously, we should do this as a class.
Now, for people who haven't watched The Good Place, can you spell it out a little bit for us without the huge spoilers that come up pretty
sure.
quick, and why it might be a good fit for philosophy?
Sure. The philosophy is not even subtle in the show. It's really right out there in the front. In the show, Eleanor wakes up in episode one, and she meets Michael, who's an architect of The Good Place, who says, welcome to The Good Place, you're here.
You've died.
Yeah, you've died. Everything's great. And she meets several other people there, but she realizes she's not supposed to be there because she was, as she calls herself, a trash bag from Arizona. So she's not a good person, and she's now finding herself accidentally in the equivalent of heaven.
Well, let's give a listen to the trolley problem. This is a common thing in ethics and philosophy. This is an excerpt from one of the episodes here. The character Chidi trying to prove to the architect Michael that he knows more than him about morality.
Here, let's try this.
Oh, God! Michael, what did you do?
I made the trolley problem real so we could see how the ethics would actually play out. There are five workers on this track and one over there. Here are the levers to switch the tracks. Make a choice.
The thing is, I mean, ethically speaking...
No time, dude! Make a decision!
Well, it's tricky! I mean, on the one hand, if you ascribe to a purely utilitarian world...
So one example of the characters taking a philosophical notion and trying to put it into practice in their, not life, but I guess afterlife.
Right, yeah. And the trolley problem episode was so brilliant because I think most of us at this point use the trolley problem as our sort of touchstone when we teach utilitarianism. So I would introduce that anyway to my intro students, but now being able to show Chidi introduce it and then fail utterly to make a decision about it made it so much richer.
Now, what's fun about the show, fun and philosophy, no offense, don't always go hand in hand.
Fair.
And to the extent that I've encountered it, read it, been taught about it, it's kind of a distant, abstract thing. And this, we're seeing people, these characters, take philosophical lessons and say, how do I live them in my everyday life? Which I think is what philosophers mostly were shooting for in the first place.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think most of my students, when they walk into, like, especially an intro class, that's their impression, is that they're going to learn a bunch of high-minded stuff that's completely impractical. And I think that using The Good Place to teach them this stuff absolutely has shown them that not only, I mean, the lessons are the same, right? I'm still teaching them options about what ethics might be and questions about the existence of God and questions about what it means to be human. But they're actually watching them play out on the screen, and it means so much more to them to recognize that these are actually things that can help them live their lives better.
We're talking about philosophy, TV, and how we can learn from the two. Robin Zabrowski is with us, associate professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. She has designed a lesson plan around the TV show The Good Place. It's a comedy. It's got a lot of philosophy in it. I want to give another listen to a clip about the burrito. The characters encounter a burrito on a desk in the afterlife.
Do you think it's a test? Like, maybe one of us is supposed to eat it, or we eat it together, or maybe it's a test to see how long we can go without eating it.
I'm not scared of any burrito. I'll eat it. Unless the burrito is the judge.
Don't be so bloody ridiculous. Judges aren't food. Judges are serious people who wear long silk nightgowns and big white powdered wigs.
You could be right.
What?
Really?
I don't know. I'm just saying we've certainly seen weirder things than an all-knowing burrito. Can't take any chances.
Hello, Your Excellency. My name is Eleanor Shellstraw. We doth seek thine judgment. We've traveled a long distance to see you, oh great one.
What do you guys look like?
Hi, I'm the judge. That's a burrito.
Now, this is another, it's like a funny scene, but it's a consistent lesson in the show. Sometimes philosophy can illuminate our lives, and sometimes we can paralyze ourselves overanalyzing a situation, like a burrito on a desk in this case.
Yeah, the character Chidi in particular spent his entire life completely paralyzed, trying to do the right thing and failing to make any decisions.
But one thing that arises, and without spoiling things too much, a theme that keeps emerging is how complex it is to judge the consequences of our actions in a complicated and interactive world where we're connected with so many different things and people.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that the show does brilliantly. And I had assumed that anyone who watched the show was picking up on all of the philosophy. But as I learned this year with my students, some of them had been watching it and missed tons of things about it. But one of the things that's so great is that there are a handful of different ethical theories that sort of compete as which one could possibly be right. And Chidi is our Kantian. He always tries to do what's right for the sake of the motive. And he has moral duties that to do certain things. And they leave him completely paralyzed. And the trolley problem episode that we just listened to a clip of, that is utilitarianism that says sort of like there's just a moral calculus. You do the math and you get it right. And they both fail pretty miserably in the real world. And that's one of the things that's so great about it.
And there's an idea that, okay, maybe we don't pick just one philosophy and try to live it to the extreme, that thinking about these things can be a toolkit in a daily decision, but also how we judge whether we're living a good life or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes we get little explicit lessons from Chidi where he's teaching Eleanor some of the philosophy. And so he tells us these things explicitly. But the one book that sort of makes an appearance several times throughout all of the seasons is Tim Scanlon's What We Owe to Each Other, which is an ethical theory of contractualism, this idea that we actually ethics come from our relationships to other people and the fact that we're all on Earth together and we kind of have to help one another. And so, like, if there is a moral lesson, that's the one I think that they're trying to get at.
Now, a lot of times when people in a particular line of work, doctors, lawyers, whatever, cops, they watch a show that's supposed to be about them, they say, oh, they get all this stuff wrong. How do they do on the philosophy on The Good Place?
They do an amazing job.
Really?
They get it all right. And not only that, but like Chidi as a philosophy professor isn't just like a total laughingstock. He actually has intelligent things to say, which is so nice because we don't get to see professors on TV very often at all. And certainly not professors in the humanities, like showing that the humanities have value. Oh my goodness, this never happens on TV.
Now, this is fun for students. They get to watch the show. They have to watch the show. It's part of the homework. But it doesn't sound like it's necessarily an easy class. There's a lot of brain thinking going on here.
Yeah, the class is not wildly different than another intro to philosophy class, except for the fact that I made all of the assignments based on various episodes of the show. So certain things that happen in the show are reflected in their assignments. But otherwise, I mean, we're still reading all the same pretty tough philosophy.
As you have followed the show, it has a lot of twists and turns. Did it ever disappoint you? Did you ever feel like it let you down as it explores the philosophies here?
No, and I kept waiting for it, right? Because all TV shows let you down eventually. So I kept waiting and waiting, and no, like at every turn, even when I think I understand like the twist that's coming, it's still amazing, and I'm not always right about it. And it's just, yeah, the show, I think the fact that it's ending this season is deeply upsetting. Because we don't have a lot of shows that just show people being good and models of like friendship that are like that pure and beautiful.
Make the case, even if people aren't lured in by The Good Place, make the case for considering ideas of philosophy in our daily lives as we judge ourselves and what we do.
I mean, we're probably at the most deeply divided point in our political history, right? And philosophy has been asking questions about what it means to be good, what the nature of justice is, all kinds of these important questions, what it means to be human. And there's just, you know, thousands and thousands of years of writing on this stuff. And it feels like now more than ever, we should be looking to philosophy.
And I think a lot of people might think that sounds great. I'm not smart enough to understand this stuff. And you've got a couple characters in the show. Eleanor and Jason,
yes.
Who probably would fit that category and how they think about themselves, if they think about themselves
right.
at all in Jason's case. There is room for all of us in it?
Yeah. One of the greatest things, I think, is watching season 4 that's airing now, just watching the character of Jason suddenly, like, every time he talks, he actually has things to say that are relevant, which wasn't always the case. And there is much more accessible philosophy. Like, you don't have to go out and, like, buy a Kant book. You can certainly pick up much more accessible philosophy.
Have you seen pop culture tackle philosophical issues before? I know people have written books about, you know, philosophical lessons from The Simpsons or
yes.
The Sopranos, which I don't know if I want people guided there too closely. But have you seen other good pop culture lessons out there?
Yeah. Oh, there's so much. Even before The Good Place existed, I had been teaching some of the philosophy that I do with comic books. Like, I mean, superheroes are just ethics writ large, right? It's just the ultimate good and the ultimate evil. But also TV shows, Black Mirror. Oh, my goodness. Black Mirror. Every episode is asking really important questions that we've been doing in the philosophy of technology for just decades. But almost any show that's about human beings is in some way a show about philosophy.
So a lot of times we're considering philosophy and not really being aware of it, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah.
So give us a little homework. We're not going to go out and read Kant, or I'll speak for myself. I'm not going to. But give us some homework to think about whether we're watching The Good Place or not, to start to weigh our lives a little more philosophically.
Let's see. Well, I think there's lots of really good stuff that you could read that's accessible. I mean, my Good Place class read Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. We read an op-ed that was written by Appiah in the New York. No, in the Washington Post, that was called "What Will Future Generations Condemn Us For?" Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even the New York Times has a series, I think, called "The Stone" that sometimes runs just mm-hmm. philosophy. So, I mean, there's lots of stuff meant to be consumed as far as public philosophy goes. But if you want a slightly accessible philosophy engaging specifically with The Good Place, there is one book already out and a second one coming out, both on The Good Place and philosophy. So one is out now through Open Court Press, and another one by Blackwell will be out, I think, early 2020.
All right. Last few moments, favorite character on The Good Place?
All of them.
Really?
But I work in artificial intelligence, so Janet has a very
okay.
special place.
Very popular
in my heart.
Character. I sometimes want to be Jason Mendoza.
He's so
almost
great.
Got myself a Blake Bortles jersey at one point. Maybe someday. Maybe next birthday or something. Robin, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Robin Zabrowski, Associate Professor of Cognitive Science at Beloit College. We talked to her today about her philosophy course using the sitcom The Good Place as a teaching tool. You can post, by the way, on the Ideas Network Facebook page if you've been watching this show, if you've been thinking about your place in the world because of it. Let us know. Coming up, our guest cooks up a new recipe for better health care in America. It's not Medicare for all. It's also not entirely market-driven. We'll find out what ideas our guest doctor has on the table. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, the second half of December is a slow time in state politics, except when it isn't. Kate Archer Kent and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson round up some big year-end stories, from a clash over homelessness funding to a court ruling that would remove people from voter rolls. Get caught up in those stories and more Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to Gallup polling, no more than 28% of Americans have been satisfied with what they pay for health care going back 20 years. The average is usually around 22% satisfaction. But creating a better version of America's health care system seems like an overwhelming challenge in our modern political system. Our next guest thinks it is possible, but it might not look like the plans offered by leading politicians on either side of the aisle. Dr. Peter A. Ubel is the Madge and Dennis T. McLawhorn University Professor of Business, Public Policy, and Medicine at Duke University. His new book is called Sick to Debt: How Smarter Markets Lead to Better Care. Dr. Ubel, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. Please call me Peter.
Well, Peter, before we get to some of your ideas about improving our healthcare system, can you highlight a couple of the things that you see not working? You spent a lot of time on that in the book. Give us a couple of the lowlights.
Oh, wow. Let's start low. Okay. We are exposing people to more and more out-of-pocket costs even after they've found an insurance plan. So it used to be that once you had insurance, you had pretty robust coverage, and so you could then decide what medical care you needed for your various ailments. Now, you get sick, and you not, despite having insurance, you end up with all kinds of surprise expenses, made worse by the fact that no one tells you the price in advance. And that is a bad combination that leads people really uninformed about the consequences of their medical decisions.
And you point toward some of the solutions offered in the political system. You've got problems with a couple from the liberal and conservative sides. Let's start with the idea of, you know, whether we call it a Medicare for all or single payer. You see some flaws in the idea that everybody is covered for whatever they need.
Oh, yeah. So just I think Medicare for all and single payer are two different ideas, mm-hmm. because Medicare for all could mean everyone gets Medicare through whatever private plan they choose. So, but in either case, what you're asking about is if you had super robust coverage, whether it's private insurance or the government, where all your medical expenses were taken care of with little or no out-of-pocket costs, that's great in terms of not burdening an individual patient with their healthcare expenses. But it also means a lot of us will demand more care than we need, and we'll actually not worry at all about the price of that MRI for the shoulder we tweaked last weekend. And it will lead to too much spending. And so maybe as an individual patient, you won't be bankrupt by that next medical bill, but the country will be bankrupt by healthcare expenses.
On the other side, we see calls for a more strictly market-based approach. We all become healthcare consumers and shoppers, and that our collective wisdom will drive costs down. You don't necessarily buy that either.
No, and of course it starts off with being cruel. At an extreme, there are countries now where people only get medical care they can pay for. And so if you need life-saving heart surgery, you either pony up or you die. And that's cruel. But even if you have a system where a lot of the expense is covered but 20% is on you, people end up avoiding necessary care. They also end up bankrupt. Right now, you see when somebody comes in with a cancer diagnosis in the United States, they have about a 2- or 3-fold risk, elevated risk of individual bankruptcy. So people are losing their life savings from illnesses that that lead to all these extra costs.
Talk about the difficulties in shopping for healthcare, whatever the system, whether I'm paying completely out of pocket or 10 or 20% out of pocket. What are the challenges that face us as healthcare consumers when we're trying to see what the best deal is going to be for us?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. One of the things I try to do in the book is bring policy to the bedside. And I actually been very lucky to have probably the most we have looked at more doctor-patient interactions than anybody around to find out what happens when they talk about costs. And you'd think when you're shopping for healthcare, there's one person for sure who'd help you figure out the cost of things would be your own doctor. And we find hordes of examples of patients saying, well, how much will that new medicine cost me? Or what will that test cost? And the doctors have no idea. And they spend inordinate amounts of time trying to figure out the cost, and they can't. Or you find people then getting on the phone and calling up a hospital and saying, I need a hip replacement. How much will that cost? You have about a 10% chance of finding out the full cost in time before you receive your surgery. And then finally, they try to figure out the cost of their own insurance, and they don't understand the plans well enough to know what it'll actually cost them. They might know what the monthly premium is, but they don't know what out-of-pocket costs they'll be exposed to. So people just don't understand the price of medical care in time to inform their decisions.
Talking to Dr. Peter A. Ubel, his new book is called Sick to Debt, How Smarter Markets Lead to Better Care. You have a variety of solutions on the table here, but big picture, you say maybe a huge overhaul where we tackle everything at once isn't the best way to tackle this. Why is that?
I actually think we need to tackle a fair number of things at a time. Mm-hmm. I just don't have a magic recipe for you. I have a bunch of ingredients I throw out there. And I think we need to figure out as a society which ones to mix together and what ratios and what we need to bake it at. But so we can't centrally plan a healthcare economy, but we can start adding in features that we know will make it better than the really kind of awful system we have right now. It starts with making those prices easier to find. Right now, your insurance company knows how much you're going to have to spend for that MRI, but it doesn't always make it easy for you to find that out. Your hospital that you go to knows how much they're going to charge for that procedure you're going to get, but they're not making it easy for you to find that out. And part of that's because both the insurance companies and the hospitals don't want other insurance companies and other hospitals to know what price they've agreed on. And so you see that the system is trying to hide that information from us So one ingredient, I think, of an improved system is to mandate that those prices get out there and out of the dark.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. You write the same hospital, the same provider might have a different cost for a Medicaid patient. They might have negotiated a price for hip replacement with one insurance company that's low, but something else is high. But insurance company B, it's the other way around. So if you ask a hospital, what is your price? The answer might be, which price?
Right. So you don't ask what your price is. You say, what are your prices? how much do you charge for whom? And that's got to be out there. And then I think your insurance company needs to make it easy for you to pull an app up and find out, because there might be a certain price for it, but then there's the price you have to pay. And then there's the price you have to pay depending on whether you paid off your deductible or not for the year. And so all those things, we could make that right there in people's fingertips if we wanted to, but without pressure to do so from either employers or the government, it hasn't been happening.
To make it even more complicated, you write, I think under the Affordable Care Act, you wrote that a colonoscopy screening is covered. You might go in knowing you're not going to pay for the colonoscopy screening, but if they find a polyp and remove it, as doctors will often want to do, well, that might not be covered.
Yeah, so healthcare is hard to figure out prices because you start one direction and then the trajectory changes. So we can't predict everything that's going to happen. It's one of the reasons why we shouldn't make all of healthcare, of trying to control healthcare expenses, we can't put that all on patients to savvily shop our way into an affordable healthcare system because there's always going to be unexpected things. And so we need a system that, in addition to certainly putting price information out there so people can look at it, we actually need a system to make the prices rational. Because if you need the care, it should be affordable, both for you and for society. And right now, instead, we have outrageous prices, 2, 3, 5, 6 times higher in the United States than in other developed countries. No way of rationalizing those prices. No way of making sure those prices reflect value, like how much benefit are you getting? For a quick example, my wife has advanced cancer. She gets more than $200,000 a year of medications. I'm really glad she's on those medicines, and I'm glad they're working. But at that price, if society is basically bearing the cost of this care, when if we were getting those same medications in the United Kingdom, they'd be a third as expensive.
And you're not just talking about out-of-pocket. Whoever's paying for it, that other system is paying less money regardless of where it's coming from for that same drug. Do I have that right?
That's right. And so I'm concerned about healthcare spending very much so for like individual people and their wallets being emptied when they get sick. That is very disturbing, and I tell lots of stories of people who run into this problem. But I'm worried about society going bankrupt too. And so even if insurance pays for something that's really expensive, the question is, why are we letting hospitals or drug companies or device manufacturers charge that much money?
We'll get into that point in just a minute. We're talking to Dr. Peter Ubel about his new book. It's called Sick to Debt, How Smarter Markets Lead to Better Care. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you understand your insurance coverage? If any, do you go into a doctor's office, provider's office with an idea of what something's going to cost you? Have you been surprised? What do you think, if anything, needs to change in our system? Do you have a question for our guest about the solutions he has on the table? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with physician and behavioral scientist Dr. Peter Ubel of Duke University. We're talking about America's healthcare system, how he thinks smarter markets can offer better care and better value for our dollar. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your confusions about our healthcare system, the solutions you'd like to see, your questions for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number. Before we go to our callers, Peter, a lot of the second half of your book is talking about incentives to kind of make these prices make more sense. One example you give is in the state of California, reference pricing for procedures. It seemed really interesting. Can you talk us through how that would work?
Oh, absolutely. So let's go back to the hip replacement we just talked about mm-hmm. a while ago that people couldn't find the price of. In California, if you were a state employee and you needed a hip replacement, you go to a hospital and one of them might charge $30,000, one might charge $50,000, but if you had a $400 copay, it was the same, no difference to you which one you went to, but to the state of California, there was a $20,000 difference. So to give people an incentive to look more closely at the lower cost providers, and believe it or not, $30,000 is low cost for this procedure, they said, we're going to give you up to $30,000 for your hip replacement should you need one. If you want to choose a provider that charges more, you can, but you will pay the difference between that and the $30,000. People dramatically changed their choices. Just as importantly, a lot of providers lowered their prices to meet that threshold.
And so what ended up happening? Did we end up seeing the overall market for hip replacements change in California after that?
It did. Again, the price changes and the choices people made changed because of it. But that was only for people who had that insurance.
Right.
They kept their prices up for people with different insurance. People respond. Yeah, go ahead.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Jacob on the line in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jacob?
So I can't agree with what the speaker's saying more about price transparency. And I am coming a little late. I didn't catch the beginning of your program. I remember I was listening to NPR earlier this week, and they talked about how there's billions of unpaid hospital bills in Wisconsin. And so then one thing that comes to mind is that then other consumers and insurance companies have to pick up the tab for that. But then I'm a huge proponent for price transparency. It should be easy to find how much things cost for everyone at hospitals. And it's the same thing with drug prices. It's actually illegal to negotiate drug prices in the United States.
Yeah, illegal for Medicare, too. That's correct.
Right. Jacob, thanks for the call. A lot there. Let's talk about those drug prices. That is another thing you tackle in the book, Peter. Keeping those costs down and keeping, as our caller was saying, that transparency or getting that transparency.
Yeah, so I completely agree with what Jacob was saying. And I think so we need to get price information out there for people, and we need to battle what the prices actually are. But there are going to be times where there's a really good medicine that's still really expensive. And so I think the third thing we need to do is make sure that your out-of-pocket costs are not high when that's a really important medication or treatment for you to get. And so we need to have smarter insurance that doesn't just charge you more if something's more expensive, because if that more expensive thing is really valuable, we should pay generously for it. And maybe instead, when something's not that expensive but doesn't really do you much good, you should pay most of the cost of that. So we need smarter insurance where when the value of medical care is high, your out-of-pocket costs are low. When you benefit a lot from healthcare interventions, you shouldn't have to pay much for them.
Thanks for the call, Jacob. We'll go to Steve now with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I have a question about, you know, what I've heard at seminars I've been to on different costing structures for medical costs and such, is really the iron triangle, that it doesn't really matter what the structure you have to pay for it, the iron triangle will still be in place. And what that means is it's a combination of access, quality, and cost. You can't push on one without impacting the other. I want to know what the guest thoughts are on that. And then additionally, on drug costs in other countries, it's my understanding that a lot of manufacturers will offer their drugs in other countries, and those countries will set the price and say, if you don't set the price at this, we'll allow someone else to generically manufacture that drug. So they're kind of hamstrung and have to offer that price. Otherwise, they're kind of cut out of the market. Just want to know what the guest thoughts are on those two issues.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call. Let's tackle that iron triangle, he called it there. You can't raise access and quality without raising costs.
I thought the iron triangle was a really good Steelers football team from the 70s, but I might be wrong. So some people say when you think of the three things, access, quality, and cost, pick the two you like because you can't have all three. I think I disagree with that. We can incentivize high-quality care, but at a price that reflects the quality and benefit of that care. And in terms of access, that's just a matter of us deciding to provide insurance coverage to all Americans. And you see in Canada, they have lower costs than we do, their quality is at least as good as we do, and they have way better access. So I do think we should not give up any of the corners of the triangle.
And Steve's second point about saying, okay, drug company, charge as much as you want for a drug, but if it's over this amount, we're going to let a competitor come in and undercut you.
Or you just won't come into our market period. So that happens in the United Kingdom. If you don't price your product to reflect value, they just won't cover it. I think we need to go closer in that direction, and that is really hard for the pharmaceutical companies to walk away from. But I think it's something they need to realize when they're designing drugs. They need to find a way to bring them to market at a price that we can afford. And with no incentive to do that, they'll figure, I'll just make another drug, I'll call it a drug cancer drug, and I'll charge $100,000. And as long as it extends someone's life by 2 weeks, they'll pay for it. That's a weird incentive.
Thanks for that call, Steve. We're talking to Dr. Peter Ubel. His new book is out. It's called Sick to Debt, How Smarter Markets Lead to Better Care. Back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Milwaukee. Hello, Paul.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to touch upon being 55 years old now. In the past 5 years, I've been invited to have tests such as colonoscopies before any fecal tests because I check off one box. I'm over 50. And, you know, the physician's assistant there or the assistant doesn't ask about your lifestyle, alcohol use, red meat. It's just you tick off this box and something like a colonoscopy can be the goose that laid the golden egg because it's priced by the AMA. I'm not knocking it. It's a great test. But my approach has been in the past 5 years, use the European-based model of medicine, wherever you can find it on the web, and go there, go from there, just because there are smarter ways to approach what you may need done. And, you know, I'm not second-guessing the doctors, but at the same time, there are other options out there that may cost less or just be a better match for you medically.
Paul, what do you Paul, thanks for the call. Peter, what do you think?
I think it's a great point, Paul. In colon cancer screening is one of the things that under Obamacare you don't have copays for, but that doesn't mean it has to be a colonoscopy. It could be, like you said, the stool testing. It can be this thing called a flexible sigmoidoscopy. So there's lots of ways to screen, and one person might prefer one might prefer another. We should be given that choice.
Thanks for the call, Paul. In our last few minutes, Peter, say a congressional committee brought you in and said, okay, what are the first few things, if we can get bipartisan agreement, we should do to start moving the needle in the right direction? What's at the top of your list for them?
We've discussed a lot of them, and one reason I'm hopeful is that you're already seeing a lot of work to try to bring prices out of the dark, things like that. There's a surprise billing bill that I think it ran into trouble today, but there was bipartisan support, and I think a lot of these things are different than Medicare for All, which I think I can't imagine coming into law. Here you can come up with plans that insurance companies aren't threatened by. And so I do think price transparency is something. Why wouldn't a Republican like that? Why wouldn't a Democrat like that? That feels pretty nonpartisan. I think trying to incentivize insurance companies to have smarter designs that protect people from high out-of-pocket costs when it's necessary medical care. Really hard to think who would be against that. And so I think these kinds of ideas, really, we have hope for them. And they're very different than overhauling the entire system, abandoning private insurance completely, going to a completely free market and abandoning Obamacare. I don't think either of those are the way to go.
And very briefly, for someone out there who has to pay at least some out-of-pocket, any quick thoughts for them in the system we're living in now?
Good luck. It is be persistent. Don't take I don't know for an answer.
Good place to
find
leave it.
Out. Yeah, thank you.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Go Vikings. Oh, sorry. Uh-oh. I shouldn't have said that.
Well, can we profanity dump that? I don't think so. Thanks a lot. It's been very interesting, Peter. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dr. Peter Ubel, professor of business, public policy, and medicine at Duke University. We talked to him today about his ideas for improving America's healthcare system. That's in his new book. It's called Sick to Debt, How Smarter Markets Lead to Better Care. Coming up Monday on Central Time, as the U.S. Senate awaits articles of impeachment, a conservative attorney makes the case that this move toward impeachment actually subverts the intent of the Constitution. Bad dreams may be good for you, up to a point. A sleep researcher here in Wisconsin shares some of the latest science on the mysterious world of dreams and how we might actually be rehearsing real-life situations while we sleep. Plus, we'll meet a Wisconsin fan of Christmas lights and find out how you can control the display. You could turn the lights on and off by accessing them online. Plus, we'll look at a new Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism report on hospitals here in Wisconsin and access to various kinds of treatment. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time.